You're listening to From the Public Domain, short stories, excerpts, and essays from the public domain. I'm your host, Susie Alphins. Today's selections are Taking Care of Uncle by Carolyn Wells, The Princess and the Puma by O. Henry, The Tale of Peter Rabbit by Beatrix Potter. Taking Care of Uncle by Carolyn Wells.
Hello, Uncle Abel. Here's me. Here's your little ray of sunshine. Aunt Hetty sprung a QCD at me over the telephone and said she had to go to a meeting of some hens club or other, and would I come around here and sit with you? So I came just as soon as I could skittle over. You poor dear. Are you awfully tired of staying in the house? Well, I suppose gout is annoying. Why don't you try mental science? They say it's fine. You know, you just think you haven't any gout, and then you don't have any. Though, for that matter, you might as well think you hadn't any foot.
And then, wouldn't I have any?
No, I suppose not. But that wouldn't do any good, because I've heard that soldiers, or any people with their feet cut off, feel them hurting just the same. But never mind, poor darling. I'm going to be so entertaining this afternoon that you won't know whether you have any feet or not.
Entertaining, hey? I suppose that means you'll chatter like a confounded magpie till I'm nearly crazy. I don't see why women have to be eternally talking.
There, there, Uncle Abel. Your foot is bad today, isn't it? Aunt Hetty said you were as cross as a teething baby.
Oh, she said that, did she?
Yes, and she said she hoped to goodness I could chirp you up some, for she'd just about reached the end of her patience.
Pooh, she never had any patience. Now, if she were in my plight, full of chronic hereditary gout, and just getting over the grip.
Well, you ought to be thankful it isn't chronic hereditary grip. But man can't stand a bit of discomfort.
Confound your impertinence, miss. What are you talking about? I don't know what your aunt meant by getting you over here this afternoon. You've no more feeling or sympathy than a Dutch doll.
Oh, yes, I have, Uncle dear. Here, I'll rest your foot in an easier position.
Oh, ouch! Gosh, Lily, I wish I had something to throw at you. Get away, girl!
Oh, I'm so sorry for you poor, dear, suffering old wrapped-up bundle of foot. Here, let me put another sofa cushion under it. Say, Uncle, I saw the loveliest burnt leather sofa pillow in Van Stiles' window as I came along. It would suit my room beautifully. There, there, dear, let me rub your forehead with this cologne. Isn't that soothing?
Soothing? Nothing. You've doused it all in my eyes. They smart like fire. Oh, ouch! Lily, get out!
Well, try that mental science again. Think they don't smart. Think you haven't any eyes.
I wish I hadn't any ears. Do stop chattering, Lily.
My, Aunt Hetty sized up your state of mind all right, didn't she? Well, Uncle, I guess I'll read to you. Here's a lovely story in this new magazine. Listen. The pale young man fairly trembled as he looked at her. Ethelyn, he murmured, in sighing tones. You are so adorably subtle, so tragically intensive, that I feel.
I refuse to know how that young nincompoop felt. Shut that fool book, Lily. If you must read, read me some Wall Street news.
All right, Uncle Abel, here goes. I'll read from this morning's paper. Coffee declined rather sharply at the opening. Why, how funny! What was the opening? A sort of reception day? And if people declined coffee, why did they do so sharply? Why not say, no thank you, and take tea?
I don't want that column. Turn to gossip of Wall Street.
Yes, here that is. But Uncle, do the magnates and things gossip? I thought that was a woman's trick. Well, here we are. Steel rail changes discussed all day. Oh, Uncle. And then to call women chatterboxes, when men talk all day long about a foolish little thing like changing a steel rail? Why, I can change a whole hat in less time than that. Say, Uncle, there was the dearest hat in the Feathertons' window.
I'll bet it was dear if it was in that shop.
Well, but it had been reduced, marked down to $27.99. Such a bargain. Uncle, you know my birthday comes next week.
Well, which do you want? The hat or the sofa pillow you hinted for a while ago?
Oh, Uncle, how lovely of you. But it's hard to choose between them. Suppose I had them both sent home on approval, and then I can see.
Yes, I know what that means.
Oh, here comes the maid with your beef tea. No, Jane, let me take it. I'll give it to him. You may go, Jane. I'll just taste this, Uncle, to be sure it isn't too hot for you. Oh, how good it is. I've often thought I'd like to be an invalid just on account of the lovely things they get to eat. Why, this beef tea is delicious. And such a pretty cup and saucer. Do you know, Ethel Wiley has a whole set like this? Coalport, isn't it? Say, Uncle, what do you think about the coal strike? Do tell me all about it. I'm shockingly ignorant of politics. Do they call it a strike because the men get mad and strike each other? Or what?
Lily, if you don't want all that beef tea, I believe I could relish a little.
Oh, Uncle, how thoughtless of me. I've sipped nearly all of it. I suppose I sort of thought I was at a tea. But I think there's as much as you ought to take. Dear Uncle, it's so nice to see you eat something nourishing. I'm sure it will do you good. It must be awful to have the grip. And you have headache, haven't you? Now don't say no. I can see it in your poor dear eyes. I'm going to tie this wet bandage round your forehead. So. Oh, no, it isn't dripping down your neck. It can't be. Well, it will soon stop. Now, I'll rub this menthol on the bridge of your nose. Now, now, Uncle, don't scowl like that if you won't try mental science. We must use remedies.
Lily, if you don't let me alone, I'll throw this cup and saucer at you.
Oh, Uncle dear, don't be so peevish. There now, I'll pat your poor foot and sing to you.
Ouch! Oh, the devil! Lily, get out! There!
Oh, Uncle, you've smashed that lovely coalport. Did those gentle little pats hurt your foot? I don't believe it. I declare, a man is worse to take care of than a baby. Thank goodness. Here comes Aunt Hetty.
The Princess and the Puma by O. Henry. There had to be a king and queen, of course. The king was a terrible old man who wore six-shooters and spurs and shouted in such a tremendous voice that the rattlers on the prairie would run into their holes under the prickly pear. Before there was a royal family, they called the man Whispering Ben. When he came to own 50,000 acres of land and more cattle than he could count, they called him O'Donnell, the Cattle King. The queen had been a Mexican girl from Laredo. She made a good, mild, Colorado Claro wife, and even succeeded in teaching Ben to modify his voice sufficiently while in the house to keep the dishes from being broken. When Ben got to be king, she would sit on the gallery of Espinosa Ranch and weave rush mats. When wealth became so irresistible and oppressive that upholstered chairs and a center table were brought down from San Antone in the wagons, she bowed her smooth, dark head and shared the fate of the Danae. To avoid Lay's Majesty, you have been presented first to the king and queen. They do not enter the story, which might be called The Chronicle of the Princess, The Happy Thought, and The Lion That Bungled His Job. Josepha O'Donnell was the surviving daughter, the princess. From her mother, she inherited warmth of nature and a dusky, semi-tropic beauty. From Ben O'Donnell, the royal, she acquired a store of intrepidity, common sense, and the faculty of ruling. The combination was one worth going miles to see. Josepha, while riding her pony at a gallop, could put 5 out of 6 bullets through a tomato can swinging at the end of a string. She could play for hours with a white kitten she owned, dressing it in all manner of absurd clothes. Scorning a pencil, she could tell you out of her head what 1,545 2-year-olds would bring on the hoof at $8.50 per head. Roughly speaking, the Espinosa Ranch is 40 miles long and 30 broad. but mostly leased land. Josepha, on her pony, had prospected over every mile of it. Every cowpuncher on the range knew her by sight and was a loyal vassal. Ripley Givens, foreman of one of the Espinosa outfits, saw her one day and made up his mind to form a royal matrimonial alliance. Presumptuous? No. In those days in the Nueces country, a man was a man. And, after all, the title of cattle king does not presuppose blood royalty. Often it only signifies that its owner wears the crown in token of his magnificent qualities in the art of cattle stealing. One day, Ripley Givens rode over to the Double Elm Ranch to inquire about a bunch of strayed yearlings. He was late in setting out on his return trip, and it was sundown when he struck the White Horse Crossing of the Nueces. From there, to his own camp, it was 16 miles. To the Espinosa Ranch, it was 12. Givens was tired. He decided to pass the night at the crossing. There was a fine water hole in the riverbed. The banks were thickly covered with great trees, undergrown with brush. Back from the water hole, 50 yards, was a stretch of curly mesquite grass, supper for his horse, and bed for himself. Givens staked his horse and spread out his saddle blankets to dry. He sat down with his back against a tree and rolled a cigarette. From somewhere in the dense timber along the river came a sudden, rageful, shivering wail. The pony danced at the end of his rope and blew a whistling snort of comprehending fear. Givens puffed at his cigarette, but he reached leisurely for his pistol belt, which lay on the grass, and twirled the cylinder of his weapon tentatively. A great gar plunged with a loud splash into the waterhole. A little brown rabbit skipped around a bunch of cat claw and sat twitching his whiskers and looking humorously at Givens. The pony went on eating grass. It is well to be reasonably watchful when a Mexican lion sings soprano along the arroyos at sundown. The burden of his song may be that young calves and fat lambs are scarce, and that he has a carnivorous desire for your acquaintance. In the grass lay an empty fruit can, cast there by some former sojourner. Givens caught sight of it with a grunt of satisfaction. In his coat pocket, tied behind his saddle, was a handful or two of ground coffee. Black coffee and cigarettes. What ranchero could desire more? In 2 minutes, he had a little fire going clearly. He started, with his can, for the waterhole. When within 15 yards of its edge, he saw, between the bushes, a side-saddled pony with down-dropped reins cropping grass a little distance to his left. Just rising from her hands and knees on the brink of the waterhole was Josepha O'Donnell. She had been drinking water, and she brushed the sand from the palms of her hands. 10 yards away, to her right, half concealed by a clump of sequista, Givens saw the crouching form of the Mexican lion. His amber eyeballs glared hungrily. 6 feet from them was the tip of the tail stretched straight, like a pointer's. His hindquarters rocked with the motion of the cat tribe preliminary to leaping. Givens did what he could. His six-shooter was 35 yards away, lying on the grass. He gave a loud yell and dashed between the lion and the princess. The ruckus, as Givens called it afterward, was brief and somewhat confused. When he arrived on the line of attack, he saw a dim streak in the air and heard a couple of faint cracks. Then 100 pounds of Mexican lion plumped down upon his head and flattened him with a heavy jar to the ground. He remembered calling out, "Let up now, no fair gouging." And then he crawled from under the lion like a worm, with his mouth full of grass and dirt, and a big lump on the back of his head where it had struck the root of a water elm. The lion lay motionless. Givens, feeling aggrieved and suspicious of fowls, shook his fist at the lion and shouted, "I'll wrestle you again for 20. And then he got back to himself. Josepha was standing in her tracks, quietly reloading her silver-mounted .38. It had not been a difficult shot. The lion's head made an easier mark than a tomato can swinging at the end of a string. There was a provoking, teasing, maddening smile upon her mouth and in her dark eyes. The would-be rescuing knight felt the fire of his fiasco burn down to his soul. Here had been his chance, the chance that he had dreamed of. And Momus, not Cupid, had presided over it. The satyrs in the wood were no doubt holding their sides in hilarious, silent laughter.
there had been something like vaudeville, say, Signor Givens and his funny knockabout act with the stuffed lion.
"Is that you, Mr. Givens?" said Josefa, in her deliberate, saccharine contralto. "You nearly spoilt my shot when you yelled. Did you hurt your head when you fell?"
"Oh, no," said Givens quietly. "That didn't hurt."
He stooped ignominiously and dragged his best Stetson hat from under the beast. It was crushed and wrinkled to a fine comedy effect. Then he knelt down and softly stroked the fierce, open-jawed head of the dead lion.
"Poor old Bill," he exclaimed mournfully.
"What's that?"
asked Josefa sharply.
"Of course you didn't know, Miss Josefa,"
said Givens with an air of one allowing magnanimity to triumph over grief.
"Nobody can blame you. I tried to save him, but I couldn't let you know in time."
"Save who?"
"Why, Bill. I've been looking for him all day. You see, he's been our camp pet for 2 years. Poor old fellow. He wouldn't have hurt a cottontail rabbit. It'll break the boys all up when they hear about it. But you couldn't tell, of course, that Bill was just trying to play with you."
Josefa's black eyes burned steadily upon him. Ripley Givens met the test successfully. He stood rumpling the yellow-brown curls on his head pensively. In his eye was regret, not unmingled with a gentle reproach. His smooth features were set to a pattern of indisputable sorrow. Josefa wavered.
"What was your pet doing here?" she asked, making a last stand. "There's no camp near the White Horse Crossing."
"The old rascal ran away from camp yesterday," answered Givens readily. "It's a wonder the coyotes didn't scare him to death. You see, Jim Webster, a horse wrangler, brought a little terrier pup into camp last week. The pup made life miserable for Bill. He used to chase him around and chew his hind legs for hours at a time. Every night when bedtime came, Bill would sneak under one of the boys' blankets and sleep to keep the pup from finding him. I reckon he must have been worried pretty desperate, or he wouldn't have run away. He was always afraid to get out of sight of camp."
Josefa looked at the body of the fierce animal. Givens gently patted one of the formidable paws that could have killed a yearling calf with one blow. Slowly, a red flush widened upon the dark olive face of the girl. Was it the signal of shame of the true sportsman who has brought down ignoble quarry? Her eyes grew softer, and the lowered lids drove away all their bright mockery.
"I'm very sorry," she said humbly. "But he looked so big and jumped so high that..."
"Poor old Bill was hungry," interrupted Givens, in quick defense of the deceased. "We always made him jump for his supper in camp. He would lie down and roll over for a piece of meat. When he saw you, he thought he was going to get something to eat from you."
Suddenly, Josefa's eyes opened wide.
"I might have shot you," she exclaimed. "You ran right in between. You risked your life to save your pet. That was fine, Mr. Givens. I like a man who is kind to animals."
Yes, there was even admiration in her gaze now. After all, there was a hero rising out of the ruins of the anticlimax. The look on Givens' face would have secured him a high position in the SPCA.
"I always loved them," said he. "Horses, dogs, Mexican lions, cows, alligators."
"I hate alligators,"
instantly demurred Josefa.
"Crawly, muddy things."
"Did I say alligators?" said Givens. "I meant antelopes, of course."
Josefa's conscience drove her to make further amends. She held out her hand penitently. There was a bright, unshed drop in each of her eyes.
"Please, forgive me, Mr. Givens, won't you? I'm only a girl, you know, and I was frightened at first. I'm very, very sorry I shot Bill. You don't know how ashamed I feel. I wouldn't have done it for anything."
Givens took the proffered hand. He held it for a time while he allowed the generosity of his nature to overcome his grief at the loss of Bill. At last it was clear that he had forgiven her.
"Please, don't speak of it any more, Miss Josefa. 'Twas enough to frighten any young lady the way Bill looked. I'll explain it all right to the boys.
Are you really sure you don't hate me?
Josepha came closer to him impulsively. Her eyes were sweet. Oh, sweet and pleading with gracious penitence.
I would hate anyone who would kill my kitten. And how daring and kind of you to risk being shot when you tried to save him. How very few men would have done that.
Victory rests from defeat. Vaudeville turned into drama. Bravo, Ripley Givens. It was now twilight. Of course, Miss Josepha could not be allowed to ride on to the ranch house alone. Givens resaddled his pony in spite of that animal's reproachful glances and rode with her. Side by side, they galloped across the smooth grass, the princess and the man who was kind to animals. The prairie odors of fruitful earth and delicate bloom were thick and sweet around them. Coyotes yelping over there on the hill. No fear. And yet, Josepha rode closer. A little hand seemed to grope. Givens found it with his own. The ponies kept an even gait. The hands lingered together, and the owner of one explained.
I never was frightened before, but just think how terrible it would be to meet a really wild lion. Poor Bill. I'm so glad you came with me.
O'Donnell was sitting on the ranch gallery.
Hello, Reap, he shouted. That you?
He rode in with me, said Josepha. I lost my way and was late.
Much obliged,
called the cattle king.
Stop over, Rip, and ride to camp in the morning.
But Givens would not. He would push on to camp. There was a bunch of steers to start off on the trail at daybreak. He said good night and trotted away. An hour later, when the lights were out, Josepha, in her nightrobe, came to her door and called to the king in his own room across the brick-paved hallway.
Say, Pop, you know that old Mexican lion they call the Gotcheared Devil? The one that killed Gonzalez, Mr. Martin's sheepherder, and about 50 calves on the Salado Range? Well, I settled his hash this afternoon over at the White Horse Crossing. Put two balls in his head with my .38 while he was on the jump. I knew him by the slice gone from his left ear that old Gonzalez cut off with his machete. You couldn't have made a better shot yourself, Daddy.
Bully for you, thundered Whispering Ben from the darkness of the royal chamber.
The Tale of Peter Rabbit by Beatrix Potter. Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits, and their names were Flopsy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and Peter. They lived with their mother in a sandbank underneath the root of a very big fir tree.
Now, my dears, said old Mrs. Rabbit one morning, you may go into the fields or down the lane, but don't go into Mr. McGregor's garden. Your father had an accident there. He was put in a pie by Mrs. McGregor. Now run along, and don't get into mischief. I'm going out. Then old Mrs. Rabbit took a basket and her umbrella and went through the wood to the baker's. She bought a loaf of brown bread and 5 currant buns. Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail, who were good little bunnies, went down the lane to gather blackberries. But Peter, who was very naughty, ran straight away to Mr. McGregor's garden and squeezed under the gate. First, he ate some lettuces and some French beans, and then he ate some radishes. And then, feeling rather sick, he went to look for some parsley. But round the end of a cucumber frame, whom should he meet but Mr. McGregor? Mr. McGregor was on his hands and knees planting out young cabbages, but he jumped up and ran after Peter, waving a rake and calling out, "Stop, thief!" Peter was most dreadfully frightened. He rushed all over the garden, for he had forgotten the way back to the gate. He lost one of his shoes among the cabbages, and the other shoe amongst the potatoes. After losing them, he ran on 4 legs and went faster, so that I think he might have got away altogether if he had not unfortunately run into a gooseberry net and got caught by the large buttons on his jacket. It was a blue jacket with brass buttons, quite new. Peter gave himself up for lost and shed big tears,
But his sobs were overheard by some friendly sparrows, who flew to him in great excitement and implored him to exert himself. Mr. McGregor came up with a sieve, which he intended to pop upon the top of Peter. But Peter wriggled out just in time, leaving his jacket behind him, and rushed into the tool shed and jumped into a can. It would have been a beautiful thing to hide in, if it had not had so much water in it. Mr. McGregor was quite sure that Peter was somewhere in the tool shed, perhaps hidden underneath a flower pot. He began to turn them over carefully, looking under each. Presently, Peter sneezed, "Ka-choo!" Mr. McGregor was after him in no time and tried to put his foot upon Peter, who jumped out of a window, upsetting three plants. The window was too small for Mr. McGregor, and he was tired of running after Peter. He went back to his work. Peter sat down to rest. He was out of breath and trembling with fright, and he had not the least idea which way to go. Also, he was very damp with sitting in that can. After a time, he began to wander about, going lippity-lippity, not very fast, and looking all around. He found a door in a wall, but it was locked, and there was no room for a fat little rabbit to squeeze underneath. An old mouse was running in and out over the stone doorstep, carrying peas and beans to her family in the wood. Peter asked her the way to the gate, but she had such a large pea in her mouth that she could not answer. She only shook her head at him. Peter began to cry. Then he tried to find his way straight across the garden, but he became more and more puzzled. Presently, he came to a pond where Mr. McGregor filled his water cans. A white cat was staring at some goldfish. She sat very, very still, but now and then the tip of her tail twitched, as if it were alive. Peter thought it best to go away without speaking to her. He had heard about cats from his cousin, little Benjamin Bunny. He went back towards the tool shed, but suddenly, quite close to him, he heard the noise of a hoe. Scritch, scratch, scratch, scritch. Peter scuttered underneath the bushes, but presently, as nothing happened, he came out and climbed upon the wheelbarrow and peeped over. The first thing he saw was Mr. McGregor hoeing onions. His back was turned towards Peter, and beyond him was the gate. Peter got down very quietly off the wheelbarrow and started running as fast as he could go along a straight walk behind some black currant bushes. Mr. McGregor caught sight of him at the corner, but Peter did not care. He slipped underneath the gate and was safe at last in the wood outside the garden. Mr. McGregor hung up the little jacket and the shoes for a scarecrow to frighten the blackbirds. Peter never stopped running or looked behind him till he got home to the big fir tree. He was so tired that he flopped down on the nice soft sand on the floor of the rabbit hole and shut his eyes. His mother was busy cooking. She wondered what he had done with his clothes. It was the second little jacket and pair of shoes that Peter had lost in a fortnight. I'm sorry to say that Peter was not very well during the evening. His mother put him to bed and made some chamomile tea, and she gave a dose of it to Peter. 1 tablespoon to be taken at bedtime. But Flopsy, Mopsy, and Cottontail had bread and milk and blackberries for supper. The end. You've been listening to From the Public Domain. Today's selections were read by Susie Alphons. This is your host, Susie Alphons.